Could the Oscar-winning film Oppenheimer actually be reversing its own commitment regarding the dangers of the atomic bomb? Does Hollywood as an institution have an understated role as advancing war and state propaganda in subtle ways? Is it a coincidence that Alexei Navalny's death and prominent display in the mainstream media is happening at the same time as critical losses for Ukraine? Are Russian successes in the Ukraine war leading NATO leaders to accept defeat or take resistance to the nuclear level? This week on the Global Research News Hour, first broadcasting on the Ides of March, we are viewing the prospect of war, possibly the ultimate nuclear war erupting in the wake of current affairs happening in the battlefield and in our own movie-going culture. In our first half hour, writer and documentary filmmaker Greg Mitchell returns to the show to talk about the ways in which the anti-war, anti-nuclear movement is betrayed in Chris Nolan's Oscar-winning film and how Hollywood itself is a producer of pro-war propaganda. Then in our second half hour, we talk to journalist and geopolitical and military analyst Drago Bozhnik about the slow-motion victory by Russia in Ukraine and how NATO's determination to prevail may force us to endure the reality of what Oppenheimer warned us about decades ago. On this week's program, March, the month of war. Could recent developments in Ukraine launch World War III? Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of March 15th, 2024. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are featured on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. We acknowledge that this show was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Ininu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The settlers of what is called North America secured land, water, and resources from the indigenous peoples who were here first, without compensation or honoring faulty promises and treaties that allowed access. The colonialism and genocides that resulted are part of the legacy the current generation has inherited and must strive to honor their partners through the sharing of gifts and reparations. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. While the U.S. publication Foreign Policy accepts Putin's case on non-NATO Ukraine and concedes that Russia cares more for Ukraine than the West, there is great dissension within the Western alliance. Jens Stoltenberg, speaking at Sweden's NATO membership ceremony, continues the war rhetoric. Surrender is not a peaceful solution. We need to keep making Ukraine strong. We need to show Putin that he won't get what he wants on the battlefield. That comes from the article Stoltenberg Delusion, Ukraine's Military Losses, West Weakens on Non-NATO Ukraine, by Rodney Atkinson and Dmitry Babich, posted March 13th, originally published on Free Nations. In November 2022, the Reid-Inhofe Amendment to the FY 2023 National Defense Authorization Act, or NDAA, invoked wartime emergency powers to authorize an extraordinary shopping list of weapons like the ones sent to Ukraine, and approved billion-dollar, multi-year, no-bid contracts with weapons manufacturers to buy 10 to 20 times the quantities of weapons that the United States had actually shipped to Ukraine. Retired Marine Colonel Mark Kansian, the former chief of the Force Structure and Investment Division in the Office of Management and Budget, explained, quote, "This isn't replacing what we've given Ukraine. It's building stockpiles for a major ground war with Russia in the future," unquote. So, the United States is preparing to fight a major ground war with Russia, but the weapons to fight that war will take years to produce, and with or without them, that could quickly escalate into a nuclear war. That comes from the article, "Are We Stumbling Into World War III in Ukraine?" by Media Benjamin and Nicholas J.S. Davies, posted March 13th. Next, Bloomberg misinformation attributed the deaths and damaged health to COVID, not to the quote-unquote vaccine. Here is Jason Gale spinning the facts away from the quote-unquote vaccine to COVID itself. Quote, "I've not seen any data or research in peer-reviewed journals proving that immunizations caused a quarter of a million excess cardiovascular disease deaths in the U.S., only the opposite, that they saved millions of lives," unquote. This is an amazing statement considering that the evidence is so overwhelming that Big Pharma shills are now trying to close down or discredit the Vaccine Adverse Effects Reporting System. See this. Harvard University, which has turned out to be another lie factory, has been forced to drop its quote-unquote vaccine mandate, but continues to, quote, strongly recommend, unquote, that faculty and students, quote, stay up to date, unquote, by taking the boosters. That comes from the article, "Big Pharma and its Bloomberg News, Annenberg Center, and Harvard University shills adjust the COVID vax cover-up and advance the displacement of reality," by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted March 13th, originally published on the Institute for Political Economy. Justin Trudeau is trying to pass Bill C-63 into law, which would make it illegal to, quote, "express hate on the internet," unquote. First, let's look up the word hate in the Oxford Dictionary to keep us somewhat rooted in reality. Quote, "hate, intense or passionate dislike," unquote. So, the Liberal government is trying to make it illegal to express an intense dislike for somebody or something. The proposals contained in Bill C-63 are so bizarre and outrageous that most would dismiss them outright, says host Bob Metz in last week's episode of Just Right. Like something out of a science fiction horror fantasy, the bill allows the government to convict, fine, and imprison for life people who have not committed any speech offense, but who may do so in the future. That comes from the article, "Prime Minister Trudeau's Bill C-63, quote, like something out of a science fiction horror fantasy," unquote, by John C.A. Manley and Ezra Levant, posted March 13th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Film Oppenheimer, about the life of the famous scientist J. Robert Oppenheimer and his work developing the atomic bomb, won multiple Oscars at the Academy Awards last Sunday, including Best Picture. The director, Chris Nolan, said it was originally influenced by the nuclear threat in the 1980s and today how the fear it could resurface after Russia invaded Ukraine 2 years ago. But as our next guest reminds us, it has significant failings as an anti-war picture. We asked him to address some of these flaws on our show. Greg Mitchell is a direct documentary filmmaker. He's written about the film multiple times as part of his Substack, Oppenheimer and the Legacy of His Bomb. He joined us recently to share his thoughts about the picture.
Could I ask you to state, what are your principal concerns given the amount of time you yourself have invested in studying the development of the bomb and its
Right.
aftermath?
Yeah. I have a lot of background in the subject, a lot of background, even you might say, in the whole the project of the book and the movie. So when I went to an early screening last July, I had fears and I had hopes, and I came out feeling, it's brilliantly made movie and brilliantly acted and many great sequences and all that. But I was disappointed in how it handled the actual decision to use the first bomb, what happened after using the first bomb, and the what you know what basically what the lessons are for today, in the film's failure to honestly cover those those key issues. So I guess that's a long-winded way of getting to my precise problems with the film in the in that in those areas. So one, I got a lot of other people have talked about this. It does not show the Japanese victims at all. The only person in the film who's really shown suffering is a woman when Oppenheimer's kind of celebrating the use of the bomb, and her face is seen melted in his imagination. And in fact, the actress is his daughter, is Christopher Nolan's daughter, who of course is not even Asian. So Nolan made has explained, and Kai Bird has explained that it's two things. They thought it's more powerful if they don't show, let people imagine what happened. And the second thing is they have claimed that, well, they couldn't even really show it because the whole film is from Oppenheimer's perspective. And of course, Oppenheimer did not go to Japan. He did not see what happened on the day of the blasts. So the latter claim I find really questionable because, number one, probably about a third of the film is not from Oppenheimer's perspective. It's all about this Louis Strauss, played by Robert Downey, and the going after Oppenheimer after the war and his security hearing and his wife and so forth. So I think that's weak. And secondly, as I've written on my Substack, and I certainly would encourage people to find my Substack, which is called Oppenheimer and the Legacy of His Bomb, which I started last July, figuring I would keep it going for about a month in the life of the movie. But then the movie became such a big hit, and issues of nuclear weapons, of course, have not gone away. So I keep posting every week. So if I certainly encourage people to find the Substack and subscribe if they're interested. It's still free. As I wrote there, just there's one key scene that some people point to as well. It shows that Oppenheimer really was troubled by what happened with the use of the bomb. And it's a scene in a screening room, probably at Los Alamos. Other people are around, and Oppenheimer with Cillian Murphy is in the audience, and there's obviously some sort of footage unfolding on the screen which you can't see, and there's a narrator that says, after the bombing, the survivors suffered, and et cetera, et cetera. And very, very briefly, Oppenheimer in the scene looks a little bit anguished and troubled by what he's watching, and then it cuts away very quickly. I found that back in around 1980, a series I watched on PBS called Oppenheimer, starring young Sam Waterston, 8-part series, I think, had an almost identical scene. Sam Waterston is in a screening room at the Los Alamos. He's watching a screen. He looks anguished. There's a narrator talking about the effects of the bomb. But in the PBS series, they quickly switch to the screen. And so for maybe 30 seconds, 40 seconds, you actually see what Oppenheimer is watching. And of course, that was not done with Christopher Nolan. And it could have easily been done if you want the film supposed to be from Oppenheimer's perspective. Well, this was from Oppenheimer's perspective. He's watching the screen. So one movie, you don't see what's on the screen. And the other movie you do. So I find that claim bogus as well. There were numerous ways they could have had showed some of the victims. It's still from Oppenheimer's perspective. So that's a complaint you've probably heard a lot. That's gotten a lot of a relatively a good amount of expression in the media. The other issue, there are three or four other issues, but I'll probably just limit it to one other one, a very key one, is that the film, despite what people sometimes say afterwards or the hype about it, that it's, you know, shows that Oppenheimer was really against the bombing, or this is a great lesson that you can't use nuclear weapons, or, you know, he created this weapon and he didn't know it would end up being used against Japanese civilians and so on and so forth. In reality, the movie, if you watch it carefully, it actually supports the use of the bombs against Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Every argument that someone raises about, well, maybe we should have a test, or maybe we should wait, or isn't this going to be awful? You know, each one is met by an argument by a military person or by Oppenheimer himself, or General Groves, that, you know, this is the only way the Japanese will ever surrender, and we have to shock them, and, you know, look how bad, how many people have died already in the war, and look how bad the Japanese have behaved in Pearl Harbor and so on and so forth. So if you rewatch the movie, you'd see that every point that's raised about not using the bomb is shot down rather quickly. And so people have interpreted the fact that Oppenheimer seems to be anguished after the use of the bomb. But in reality, in the movie, it's all Oppenheimer looking ahead. It's that he created this weapon that in the future could, you know, destroy the world, or it could be an evil weapon. It's never specifically about Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And so, and right up to the end of the movie, the famous final scene with Albert Einstein, you know, it's a warning for the future. This terrible weapon that Oppenheimer helped create, but not the fact we'd already used it and we're the only people to use it. And, you know, we killed 200,000 people, 80% of them civilians, mainly women and children. That's not really critiqued in the movie. And the reason that's so important, as I've written for maybe four decades now, is in America, it's not true of the rest of the world, but in America, it's still more people than not question polled will say, well, we had to do it, or I basically support Truman's decision, and minority say otherwise, but that's been the majority opinion from the start. And of course, it's rarely challenged in the media. It's rarely challenged by officials, U.S. presidents, military. And it's always the, you know, the cliche that, you know, again, this is the only, this is what ended the war. This is the only thing that ended the war. This is the only thing that could have ended the war. And, and Oppenheimer itself, I'd be surprised if after this movie, those numbers would change at all. There might be a little more awareness of, you know, fear about nuclear weapons, or. Let me finish one thing. The reason that's so important today is that the U.S. still has a first use policy. And that's what, you know, most people don't even understand. We still have, as our official policy, that it's okay, maybe even desirable in some cases, to use the bomb first. If we, in any kind of international crisis, we don't even have to be attacked. If we are attacked, it can be by conventional means. It's not in response to a nuclear attack. We still have a first use policy. And the fact that in America, most people, and certainly most in the media, if not historians, continue to support the use of the bomb back then, it's set an incredible precedent where you could easily imagine, you know, a U.S. president using nuclear weapons again. With the feeling that, well, you know, we supported it in 1945, it's a terrible thing, but, you know, there is a precedent for not just a precedent for using the bomb, but for accepting the use, even endorsing, even celebrating the use. And Oppenheimer does nothing to undermine that. So even after that movie and the popularity and the awards, as many experts have said just in the past couple of weeks, nuclear dangers today are greater than ever, nuclear threats greater than ever. And part of that is because, you know, this sort of de facto acceptance of using nuclear weapons, no matter what people say, when they say never again, or these weapons are too terrible to use, or all the cliches. In fact, we, most Americans and officials, still support the use of it against two cities. And, you know, could support again.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Oscars generally, and maybe you could say Hollywood as well, but it has a tendency to focus on films that play a role in rewriting history, I guess you could say. And that reminds me of in the Oscars, there was a documentary filmmaker who won for his film 20 Days in Mariupol.
Right.
And he said in his speech, quote, you know, because cinema forms memories and memories form history. Right. That's kind of interesting, because, you know, I'm wondering, you know, how you would apply that principle to, you know, what you think Hollywood's treatment of screening films on atomic weapons.
Yeah. Well, when we talked last summer, I think when Oppenheimer first came out, we talked a lot about my book about the first movie from Hollywood on the subject, called The Beginning or the End, which is also the title of my book. It came from MGM in 1947. It was a big budget for its time. And it, you know, just in a nutshell, it started out inspired by the atomic scientists, not Oppenheimer, but atomic scientists who were concerned about the use of the bomb in Japan and future use. And so the first screenplays were, you might say, raised critical questions about both the bombing of Japan and the future nuclear weapons. And once the Pentagon and the White House got wind of that, they were allowed by MGM to weigh in on the script. And basically the script was almost totally rewritten. Even President Truman got involved and got a couple key scenes edited. So it became pro-bomb propaganda. And that's how this whole era began, with a Hollywood drama that was, you know, nakedly pro-bomb. Now, I don't think Oppenheimer is pro-bomb exactly, but all these decades later, it still was afraid to, you know, really raise questions about the use of the bomb, you know, in 1945, what that's said about us now. And then, of course, also going back to the MGM movie, right to the present, no showing of victims of the bomb or survivors. And, you know, you referred to a film I made last year, which is still up at the PBS site. I would urge everyone to, if you go to pbs.org, you will still find it, called Atomic Cover-Up. And again, in a nutshell, it basically shows how all the most important footage shot in Hiroshima and Nagasaki after the bombings, both by a U.S. military crew and a Japanese newsreel crew, you know, were suppressed and buried for decades. And so in that key period of 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, the American public was not allowed to see the most important footage shot after the bombing. So so that film's called Atomic Cover-Up. It's won numerous awards, et cetera, et cetera. And so you can go to pbs.org and find it. But the point is that this has been the experience in America since 1945, both in Hollywood and in other forms of media, and you know, what's been suppressed, what's been denied, and it, you know, again, partly then you know, there are good aspects of Oppenheimer movie, the new movie, certainly, you know, it sort of has carried on to this day. And I will just always say Christopher Nolan missed a golden opportunity to really do something about this. I think he thinks he's done something about it. I think he thinks the warnings about the bomb at the end of the movie, you know, are powerful and, you know, influence a lot of people, particularly young people, he claims. But I haven't seen any evidence of a big surge in an anti-nuclear movement. Some people thought this movie would spark a return to the 1980s or an earlier period of vast anti-nuclear movement and activism. And, you know, there was some of that when the movie first came out, but you know, I don't see anything now that's anything exceptional or out of the norm. So I think that's I don't so I think the movie didn't no matter what Nolan says, I don't think the movie is you know, I can't say what's in people's minds.
I'll add to that that during the speeches, I mean, I think the only person who, like all the awards that Oscars won, that Oppenheimer won, and the only one that actually mentioned, you know, the peacemakers was Cillian Murphy.
That's a cliche. I mean, I loved Cillian Murphy for 20 years, you know, but you know, okay, bless the peacemakers. Okay,
but for sure,
what does that mean?
But at least it's something. But
it's something.
Yeah, but I guess I want to ask about you know the broader stream, because I know that like in the mainstream media, just as the mainstream has been said about the mainstream media, Hollywood seems to have a function beyond entertainment of manufacturing consent for certain key military and state issues of interest. Could you possibly comment about this tendency based on what you yourself have observed about the role of Hollywood, you know, generally functioning in a dual way?
Well, yeah, I mean, entertainment was important. Now, I don't think, you know, I'm not sure if people ever considered the Nolan movie entertainment. I mean, it was tied to the Barbie movie, and they kind of brilliantly attached themselves to the fun around Barbie and Barbenheimer and everything else. So, and of course, it was a massive success at the box office. So you might say it was entertaining enough, or people like to watch big bombs go off, or they liked the actors in the film. But it is ironic that Oppenheimer producers and studios attached this supposedly very serious, crucial, world-changing film to something as frivolous as Barbie. The only place that called that out was in Japan, when they were scheduled to release Oppenheimer there during the winter, and there was so much protest in Japan over this kind of posters that were promo and posters of Barbie and Oppenheimer together, and a bomb going off in the background, and so there was sort of a desperate attempt to commercialize Oppenheimer, and it certainly worked. So, but in terms of creating consent, or creating what people will remember decades, or what they think was history decades from now, it's true. Hollywood, whether it was all the movies about the Vietnam War, and you know, when I was younger, and going up later, the Gulf War and Watergate and all sorts of issues, a great number of people, when they think of those issues, think of it via a movie, or how something was presented in a movie, whether it was factually correct or not. But that it definitely, movies have that ability to do that, and have done that in many cases. So it does kind of create history, make these movies that are entertaining or partly fictional actually become how people see actually factual history in the future. So so I'm not sure the Nolan movie is going to help in that regard when we look back 10 years from now or 20 years from now.
Yes. Very insightful. Thanks so much for this discussion, Greg.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me on again.
Greg Mitchell's a filmmaker and author who focuses much of his work on the nuclear bomb.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
It seems like the Russians are winning more ground in Ukraine every hour. Even the legacy media can't help but admit it. Currently, the U.S. is using the sour situation to hand a huge layer of guilt on Republicans in Congress who are blocking more military aid to the country. But as several analysts on this program have indicated, Russia has already won. It's just a matter of time. So we can expect the losing side to eventually either admit defeat or double down with their own forces. What are they likely to do? Joining us now is another such analyst. His name is Drago Bozhnich. Drago Bozhnich is an independent geopolitical and military analyst and a regular contributor to Global Research. As senior editor at the now defunct Fort Rus News, he wrote about military technology, global economics, and geopolitics, with a special focus on the Middle East, Balkans, Russia, China, United States, Europe, and the great power rivalry. He joins us now to focus on the state of the two-year-long Ukraine war. Mr. Bozhnich, thank you very much for joining us.
The pleasure is all mine.
Let's start with the headline story based on your just released article, Missiles Near Russia, F-35s with Thermonuclear Bombs. Is NATO ready for war? I bring this up because it doesn't strike me as a de-escalatory move. Dutch, Belgian, and Italian F-35s will be forward deployed to the area around the Baltic Sea. They're known to be able to carry nuclear weapons. The Patriot surface-to-air missile systems will be stationed in Lithuania. Just in the last few days, NATO encroachment on Russia's border is, in your own words, breaking records. Mr. Bozhnich, point to our listeners the significance of this development.
Thank you. First of all, I just want to say that this is not something new, and it's not even connected to the Ukrainian conflict itself. It's been going on for well over a decade at this point. And if we count the first Cold War era, we could even say it's 30 plus years of this encroachment. And the reason why it's dangerous is simply because of the strategic thinking of any major power in history, and that is not allowing the rival power to come close to its heartland. And that's exactly what's going on with the NATO expansionism towards Russia's borders, because as they grow as they come closer, then Russia feels more threatened. And obviously, the reaction is not going to be kind when it comes to that. In this case, I mentioned the air defense systems, which are being installed in the Baltic states. And now it's going to be Finland as well. The reason why this is dangerous is because such systems, although their primary, focus is defense, actually can be used in an offensive way. So this is actually one of the major problems why the Russians see that as a threat. This is not to say that the Patriot is some super system that can defeat any sort of air force, despite what the mainstream propaganda machine is trying to convince us. It's just that there are many such systems that are being deployed. So what they lack in quality, they make up in quantity. And the quantity keeps increasing basically as we speak. And there are other systems which are also being used to augment the Patriot, and which are also not less of a threat to the Russians. And of course, then there's that's the defensive potential that can be used in an offensive way. But then there also the F-35s you mentioned are clearly an offensive potential. Like it's not a secret what the purpose of F-35s is there, especially when they're armed with nuclear weapons. In this case, we're talking about thermonuclear B-661 bombs, specifically the 12th variant. Although now the F-35s are being changed so they can carry the latest variant, which is the B-61-13, which has a higher yield. I think it's up to 330, 350 kilotons, which, to put it in a perspective, that's around 23 to 25 times the destructive power of the Hiroshima bomb. So in that regard, I don't see how the Russians wouldn't see that as a destabilizing move. And if you move, if another power moves such destructive weapons close to the other power's heartland, then we're very much close to a global conflict which could destroy the whole world, essentially.
Yeah. Is it a possibility, though, that it could be like an enormous bluff, you know, that you've forced the Russians, okay, we're going to back down because you got this huge collection of people on the outskirts of our territory?
Well, I mean, the problem is the Russians have nowhere to back off, like where, because they're essentially only in their own territory in those areas, plus Belarus. That's it. Like that's all space they have. And essentially, if you look at the map, and if you compare that to the 1941 situation after Hitler invaded the Soviet Union, it's very much similar with the obvious exception of Belarus. So the Russians essentially, it's just not in their interest to allow such a strategic situation, because it's not just about the military moment. It's about the geopolitical interests of Russia. And we know the history of NATO involvement in the destabilization process in the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. So what would happen next is they would try to break Russia apart from the inside by financing and supporting all sorts of separatist movements, by trying to support any sort of an anti-government group in Russia that could create havoc, essentially. So this is essentially the question of life and death for Russia. And also they have to count the military situation as well, because if NATO were to put, let's say, long-range missiles in the Baltic states or Finland, they would be able to reach Moscow in minutes. If it's a hypersonic missile, well, maybe 2 minutes to Moscow. And also there's the St. Petersburg, which is essentially almost on the border itself with NATO countries, considering the fact that Finland is now a NATO member. So that puts the second most important city in Russia in range of virtually any weapon system in NATO's arsenal, including short-range ballistic systems. So Russia is not the side that's being aggressive in this case. That's pretty much obvious to anyone with any sort of basic knowledge of geography and the geostrategy, as I would say.
Yeah. I'm wanting to look back just a few weeks to the fall of Avdiivka.
Avdiivka, yeah.
The Russians are now obviously charging forward much more rapidly now. Can you explain the significance of Avdiivka to the Ukrainian Defense Forces?
Yes. Well, that settlement and the settlements around it have been essentially turned into a fortress in the last 10 years, almost 10 years. Since the Maidan coup, those areas were used to strike the Donetsk, which was the capital city of the Donbas of the Donetsk People's Republic, and essentially the central city of the Donbas for all the people who were living there. So the very fact that the Russians were able to wrestle control over that city from the AFU, from the Kiev regime forces, means that they would not be able to launch regular strikes on artillery strikes on Donetsk, which is important for the civilians who have been living there even after the SMO started. Those people have been subjected to nearly a decade of constant shelling, and there were up to 15,000 people who have been killed as a result of that. The very fact that this has stopped to a large degree now, it hasn't stopped completely, but it has stopped to a large degree, is a relief for those people. And also it gives the Russians a staging ground, so to speak, for further advancement into the Ukraine lines. And the problem for the Ukrainians now, because of the change in the political leadership, they're not able to effectively establish like a defense line in the same way that the Russians have made their own during the Ukrainian counteroffensive last year. And also the Russians are using and increasingly using these guided bombs, which are pretty much leveling down any sort of defensive line, ad hoc defensive line that the Ukrainians are trying to create, which is resulting in them going back further, so pulling back. But any attempt to try to establish a firmer line to the west of Avdiivka and these current Donbas front lines is not going very well because of the constant Russian bombardment by aviation and artillery units.
Well, you know, shortly afterward, you had the president Emmanuel Macron in late February, shortly after the fall of the city of Avdiivka to the Russians. Making a statement about, you know, sending NATO troops out onto the territory of Ukraine. I mean, basically the kind of statement, you know, because it, I mean, the Germans were kind of pushing back, and it's like they were almost like a hot potato who's going to move people in position and so on. And of course, you know, Putin responded with a very very intense statement about about basically becoming targets of his nuclear weapons. And but it's the kind of statement that world leaders have to think about very carefully before putting it in the news. I guess it's conceivable the president made a huge mistake in spite of his years in office, but it is also likely that there was a purpose to having that thought aired now. What do you, I mean, I'm not asking you to be a mind reader, but I mean, in terms of your understanding of military strategy and geopolitics, what do you think that the possible purpose of having the possibility aired, even if the people around him are dismissing it?
Well, I really hope it's an error. As you said, I'm not a mind reader. I'm not sure what he's trying to accomplish, because obviously it's not going to work. First of all, France has very little battle-ready forces that could actually go to the front line. And they've actually complained about it when the SMO in Ukraine started 2 years ago, when they said that they couldn't hold 90 kilometers of a front line. And I want to remind your listeners that the front lines in Ukraine are around 1,300 kilometers long. So they couldn't even cover, 5 to 7% of the current front line. So I'm not sure what exactly do they think is going to happen. Also, any inclusion of NATO or any NATO member state in the war means that the Russians would consider the targets in that country a legitimate military target to be destroyed or neutralized. So where would those French soldiers deploy from? Would they deploy from France, from Poland, or from Romania, from Slovakia? I'm pretty sure Mr. Orban wouldn't agree that they deploy from Hungary. So like, where are they going to move to Ukraine from? Because if they move from Poland, Poland also essentially or effectively becomes a party to the conflict. And of course, those French forces would also be a legitimate military target for the Russians in Poland. So there are many ways in which this could go very, very wrong and erupt into a pan-European conflict, or even a world or global conflict, if you want. And as I said, I really hope that he made a mistake, or maybe he was like emotional. Maybe it was an emotional reaction to everything that's going on. I think one of the reasons why France is getting more directly involved is their conflict with Russia in Africa, where the Wagner group has been wrestling control over a lot of these former French colonies, which is not very beneficial to the French economy, especially when it comes to extracting resources such as uranium, where France is around 70% dependent on nuclear power for its energy generation. So that means that if they lose access to cheap, or let's say dirt cheap Ukrainian uranium from Africa, then they're essentially all of their nuclear power plants will be in jeopardy, and France's energy security as well. So I think the Russians did that as a way to respond to France's involvement in Ukraine from the very beginnings of the crisis. And now France, feeling hurt, I suppose, is trying to push back directly. So essentially what we see is a great power conflict going over the backs of the Ukrainians, although they don't seem to understand that, or at least the government doesn't understand that. And it actually believes that NATO is helping them instead of realizing that they're just being used as cannon fodder.
Of course, didn't the German, like there was a recording of German officers talking about having people actually moving, like giving guidance to missiles, one that was going to fire at the Crimean Bridge. You know, that suggests that the Germans are on the ground and they are already supporting the Ukrainians. So, I mean, doesn't that send a signal to Putin that, okay, that Germany's on our radar screen, and, you know, perhaps others as well?
Exactly. I think Russia essentially understands everyone who are involved. So obviously, this doesn't mean that they're officially involved. I mean, NATO countries. Okay. Otherwise, the war would have happened long ago. But it is perfectly clear to anyone with any sort of military knowledge that NATO personnel are on the ground in Ukraine, and they're operating the most complex systems, NATO systems, that the Ukrainians got, because simply it's impossible for the Ukrainians to master such systems in such a short period of time. It's just impossible. It actually takes years of training to effectively use those systems, even for countries that actually buy them and the countries that operate them already. It's even worse for a country like Ukraine, which actually never had any Western or NATO sourced weapons before the SMO, unless we're counting small arms or stuff like that. I'm talking about like systems which are, let's say, on an operational level, important for the front line, and that's missile systems, air defense systems, artillery, and so on. Ukraine inherited an enormous amount of Soviet weapons, so they never really needed any Western weapons ever, essentially. But after the SMO started, they've started losing these systems very fast, because Russia is obviously much more advanced technologically. And its military has actually been upgraded the decades after the fall of the Soviet Union, which is not the case for the Ukrainians, who have essentially just inherited what they had and have done very little to modernize those systems. So essentially, we know that NATO personnel are on the ground. They're not officially NATO personnel. They're officially volunteers or mercenaries or whatever you want to call them. But their involvement is clear, because it's impossible for the Ukrainian crews to operate systems such as the Patriot, because they've never been trained to do that. And even if they're being trained actively to do it, it will take at least 2 years for them to be able to operate those systems effectively.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about Alexei Navalny. He died just days in advance, but there's this allegation that he was murdered by order of Putin, rather than seeing him released as part of a prison swap for the Russian prisoner Vadim Krasikov. Given the timing of all of this, the presence of his widow speaking about his work and with intense press coverage it received, far more than the Julian Assange, I can tell you, I find it similar to other moves of the press preparing the ground for war. So I was wondering if you could maybe comment on that.
Absolutely. Thank you for the question. I agree with you completely. The timing is perfect for the mainstream propaganda machine that keeps saying that Putin killed Navalny, which to me, it doesn't really make sense. It's not just about the fact that we don't have any proof that happened. It's just from a purely logical standpoint, what does Putin stand to gain by murdering Navalny? Like, first of all, Navalny wasn't exactly, he was never really a political threat to Putin, who has had, 60 to 80% of the support for almost 2.5 decades at this point. Navalny has never crossed single digit support, as far as I know, with probably 5% being the most that he's ever got. So, like, it's ludicrous to think that Navalny was a true political threat to Putin. I don't really think that's the case. So his death is far more beneficial to the political West than it is to Putin. So I cannot speculate how he died. The GUR, the Ukrainian military intelligence chief, Kirill Budanov, said that he died because of a blood clot, which I really don't know if that's true either. But either way, even the Western and Western aligned countries are not blaming Putin for his death. And I'm pretty sure Kirill Budanov has zero reasons to defend Putin, right? So in that regard, I think it's clear that he was, I'm not sure if he died or if he was neutralized, but if the latter is the case, then I'm pretty sure the Russians haven't done that.
Hmm. 7 days ago, Under Secretary of State for Political Affairs Victoria Nuland will retire from her position. She was a major figure of hawkishness against Russia, and her replacement will be John Bass, a former ambassador to Afghanistan who oversaw the U.S. withdrawal from the country. What does this retirement tell you about America's moves in the war? You know, again, especially given the timing. I mean, does that in some sense contradict the move, the escalatory move of the United States and NATO mentioned, well, so far?
Yes, I do think that. I do agree with that notion because, as you said, the military moves suggest that an offensive nature of their foreign policy, but the move of removing Victoria Nuland definitely sends a different message. I'm not sure what that what the goal of that is. I really hope the goal is towards de-escalation because, I mean, nobody in the world needs Russia and the United States firing nuclear missiles at each other because that's going to be the end of the world. And I keep repeating this because I cannot stress it enough. People have forgotten the lessons of the first Cold War when there was this looming danger of this, of the destruction of the planet. And people have forgotten about it and they've become laid back, not realizing what sort of power these two countries wield. And the last thing we need is see them using it against each other because we're all going to suffer the consequences. So if Victoria Nuland is being replaced or removed from that post, that sends a good message, but that's only on the, in the political arena. In the military arena, things don't seem so optimistic. I think it's important to, essentially for the United States and NATO at least, to put those steps in essentially match the steps on the military front, let's say. So they should de-escalate. They should remove a lot of their forces from Russian borders. In that way, then Russia might, you know, get the message that they're not going to be jeopardized anymore. And then that could open, let's say, the possibility of negotiations, which might, you know, contribute to a long-lasting peace in Europe. Apart from that, I don't see the move as anything else but, let's say, faking goodwill, because so the situation on the ground is not changing, it's escalating. So Victoria Nuland did her job, right? She created the created the situation where the conflict would just grow and escalate to the point that we are seeing now. So she's not really important anymore, right? She did her job and now she can retire peacefully, I guess. Well, at least she probably thinks it's peaceful. So unless NATO and the United States match such moves with moves on the ground, especially in the military arena, I don't think a lot will change.
It's beginning to look like we may soon see World War III launching. I mean, even if nobody wants it, like World War I, as you said, any mistake, any, say, false flag or any miscalculation could precipitate nuclear war and the end of the world. What would you suggest that people in the United States and Canada, for that matter, could do in the short term to stop it before it's too late?
Well, the best thing to do is to push back against the elites who want to push us, all of us, into a bloodbath. Unfortunately, I understand that a lot of people are unable to do that because the people in power they wield so much power over everyone. And we saw that during the protests, the trucker protests in Canada, where people had their bank accounts frozen, which, I mean, it doesn't seem, you know, that Canada is a democracy if something like that can happen because of people protesting. In that regard, I think a lot of people realize that they just want to avoid any trouble with the authorities. And I think, it's far from me calling for, you know, people to rebel against the government, but it's just that I think they should push back against the policies that are clearly against their against the interests of the people. And this is already happening to a large degree, but it's mostly happening on an internal level where people are more concerned, which is logical to a certain extent, but they're more concerned with their immediate, you know, benefits and the immediate life problems. But this is a sort of a strategic problem that could affect all of us, especially, as you said, if nuclear war starts. So in that regard, I think it's necessary for people to be aware of what sort of a danger we are all in at this present moment. And just as they're pushing back against this totalitarian policies, which are on the internal level, they should push back against these aggressive expansionist policies of NATO that their own governments are supporting, because those expansionist policies are not so consequential when a targeted country is like Afghanistan or former Yugoslavia or Iraq. Even then, we see the consequences, but they're not as global as those when you have countries like Russia being essentially invaded by NATO. So, I think people have forgotten that there can always be consequences of the actions of their governments, which can affect them on an internal level, even though what the government is doing is completely like seems foreign to them, because it deals with countries which are, let's say, tens of thousands of kilometers away. So in that regard, I think people should have more awareness of the foreign policy of their governments, because that affects the internal policies as well, even though it may not seem like that to an untrained eye.
Well, I guess we're going to have to leave it there, Drago, but I want to thank you very much for participating in this conversation. Your analysis is quite revealing, and we welcome it on our program.
Thank you very much, and the pleasure was all mine.
We've been speaking with Drago Bosnic, independent geopolitical and military analyst and contributor to Global Research.
Just a final footnote to that interview. It must be stated yet again that the month of March has been chosen by the Pentagon and NATO military planners as the best month to go to war. With the exception of the war on Afghanistan, October 2001, and the 1990-91 Gulf War, all major U.S. NATO and Allied-led military operations over a period of more than half a century since the invasion of Vietnam by U.S. ground forces have been initiated in the month of March. Is history going to repeat itself again? Israel-Gaza is at the center of what could erupt into a huge war as well. Listeners in Winnipeg should take note of an event being held tomorrow, Saturday the 16th, called Gaza Stories of Grief, Resistance, and Hope. Admission is free. It takes place at the Canadian Museum for Human Rights in Bueller Hall near the entrance. It features testimonies from local Palestinians with family in Gaza, as well as crafts, cultural performances and displays, and supplies educational resources and ways to take action. This event is a collaboration between the Canadian Palestinian Association of Manitoba and Independent Jewish Voices Canada. Next week, we will be reviewing the Yugoslavia War on the 25th anniversary of its start, you guessed it, in March. You're listening to the Global Research NewsHour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Ininu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.